Anybody with any appreciation of the dangers threatening our land at this current hour will be crying out unto God as they look over the land, and they will be using the term destroy not. The rising tide of sin and iniquity that courses through our nation is calling forth for destruction. The lawlessness and the viciousness that's becoming more and more obvious as years and even months go by is calling again to heaven. Come, Lord, and vindicate thine honor and destroy the wickedness that we have all around us here. The riotous assault that we have on biblical basics. And I'm talking about, well, begin at the beginning, Genesis 1, right through Genesis 3, and further beyond that, of course. But we have in Genesis 1 the attack there coming in from this gender fluidity that we're all to swallow down without any questioning today. Use neutral pronouns when you're talking to children. Don't be talking in terms of male and female and he and she and girl and boy, because that can be so offensive. Into Genesis 2, gay marriage. That first institution by God, marriage between a man and a woman, one man and one woman only, and yet again, that is under severe attack in this day. Then we end at Genesis 3. And though we read there about the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden, iniquity and rebellion against God, we're told today, you know, there's no such thing as sin anymore. And what might be sin in your eyes is not sin in mine, so don't be so judgmental. You can't go there. And yet in the Bible, the entrance of sin into the world is defined in Genesis 3, the chaos that that sin caused, the sentence that then fell upon it, and all of these pushing at the basis, ripping away the borders that God has instituted in his word, is calling, destroy us, because that's what we deserve. And all of the signs that we have around us today tell us that judgment is already in our midst, already being served upon the backs of a people who largely have turned their faces against the Lord. And they should prompt every child of God in the country today to be on her knees, closet door closed, and pleading with God, Lord, don't do to us what we deserve. Destroy not. And that's what the title of this psalm means. You'll read above the psalm there the words, I would imagine, in your Bible as well as mine, to the chief musician, Altaxeth, Mictam of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave. And that unusual word that appears there right in the title of the psalm, Altaxeth, literally means destroy not. The words Mictam of David signify what we have in our hands here in our reading tonight is a golden psalm, but more literally it means, well, it cuts deeper than that, because the term means to cut or to engrave. David's handing over the composition into the hands and the care of the chief musician. And just as we, if we're handing over a box, maybe particularly this time of year, something is coming in the post, and we have the words, handle with care, on that box that contains fragile or potentially breakable items. David here exhorts the chief musician handing over him Psalm 57 to him, make this writing permanent. Do not destroy it. Preserve this psalm. And when you begin to wander through the words of the psalm, you'll find right from the off, David is pleading here, do not destroy me. Opening verses, for example, 1 and 2, be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me. For my soul trusteth in thee, yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpast. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. We're looking at that second verse. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. The resort in his prayer, therefore, is the first thing. The resort in his prayer. Notice carefully the opening lines of our text here. I will cry unto God. David is fleeing from Saul. He's a man with a bounty on his head, and yet he's in no doubt. Now that I'm in the back of the cave looking for refuge, I have no doubt at all as to whom I need to take this matter to. He knew the direction in which to flee. He recognized there's a door of escape left open to me. He knows where he will be welcome, where he will be heard, where he will be safe. He says, I will cry unto God. Trouble comes knocking in our door. Where do we run? If we're honest, sometimes at least we'll have to admit we run to our friends. They're the first people that we tell. And the result, well, Joseph Scriven underlines it well when he said, can we find a friend so faithful? Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. And you'll notice here quickly the psalm is traveling in the one direction. It's coming out of the mouth of David here. A psalm of praise, but one of petition in the main. And it's right out of the depths of that cave up to the throne of God. Verse 1. Be merciful unto me, O God, be merciful unto me. Verse 5. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. 7. My heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. And 9. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto thee among the nations. And then verse 11, which is repeating what we have in verse 5. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. And so out of this rugged, wild hill country of Judah, there's a cry that is arrowing out in prayer from David unto his God. But notice more particularly that he uses a special title of God in Psalm 57 verse 2. I will cry unto God Most High. What does the name Most High, the Most High, indicate? Two passages. We'll pedal back right to the first appearance of this title of God as it came in Scripture. A lot of people, theologians, Bible teachers, will talk about the law of the first mention, and they will insist you can glean a lot of material when the first occurrence is there in the Bible of any particular fact or place or name or title as we have here. First time up, Genesis 14. Verse 18 through to 20, there we read, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand. And that allowed, later in the story, Abraham to respond to the king of Sodom, who had said to Abram, give me the persons, take the goods to thyself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, verse 22, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abraham rich. In other words, I have everything from the hand of the Most High God. He owns heaven. He controls everything upon the earth. I don't need to take anything, even the most minuscule thing, from the king of Sodom, when I have the Most High God on my side as my provider and my supplier. But the noteworthy thing is this. The Most High God, when first revealed in the Bible, is revealed in connection with Melchizedek. I know there's an argument, but Melchizedek was either a Christophany, that is, an appearance of Jesus Christ in the flesh before he became a babe in Bethlehem and became incarnate, or at the very least, he is the most perfect type or picture of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament scriptures. Melchizedek, identified here as the priest of the Most High God, and certainly in him we can see Jesus Christ, our great high priest. The only way that a poor sinner can stand before the eternal God, that he can take a position before the Most High God, is on the merits of Christ the Mediator. Genesis 14:18 says, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine." What does that remind us of? Brings us to Calvary. The bread and the wine. And there, as we receive the merits of the sacrifice of Christ from the hands of Jesus, our great high priest, because of his merit, we can stand before the Most High God. And we are blessed by him. So blessed that we can today look the Sodom of this world in the eye, and we can say, "Keep what you're pushing our way. We don't want a thread. We don't want a shoe latchet off you. We want the enrichment of heaven instead. No compromise with Sodom. No contamination from Sodom. No consent to Sodom. We want nothing at all to do with it." As the Most High, God possesses everything in heaven and everything in earth. He is sovereign, in other words, and we need, of course, to get that truth back into focus today. Whenever this truth, the sovereignty of God, is relegated into a blur or swept over to the one side or derailed in some system of theology, then we quite foolishly and foully give up the most powerful element that can hold us up, sustain, enable, help a child of God, the total, absolute sovereignty of God. Martin Luther was talking to Erasmus. And Erasmus in the Reformation time was coming from the line of philosophy rather than scripture. Although he did provide the reformers with a splendid Greek text from which to translate into German and English and all other languages, but Erasmus was more a philosopher. And Luther, chatting to him, said, "You know what? No matter how vital," and it really was vital, "the truth of justification by faith alone was, it wasn't really the mainspring of the Protestant Reformation. The heart of the doctrine of the Reformers was the absolute sovereignty of God." I can't speak for you, but I can for myself, and I know that I find it most reassuring to think that every angel and every devil is answerable to God and will only ever go as far as God allows them to go, and they will be used, those demons, against their will to perform the purpose of God. Take the case of Job. Instead of destroying him, wiping him from the map, taking him away from his spiritual anchorage, all the devil did was to give rise to one of the most splendid, sublime self-revelations of God's person and power that you can read off in the Bible, and then in the last chapters, leading to a climax, God humbling man, but God exalting himself. We have Herod, and we have Pilate. And they felt around the crucifixion. They were the men who had the power in their hands. They could deliberate, discuss, and then they could do as they please with Jesus Christ, the King of Glory. And Peter speaks in Acts 4, 24 to 28, and he puts it all into context. You thought Herod had the power, Pilate had the power. All they did was whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done. They couldn't go beyond the parameters of the permission of God. In Luke 8 and 28, we have the very demons crying out, what have I to do with thee, Jesus, thy Son of God, Most High? I beseech thee, torment me not. The Most High God. Second passage that we're going to refer to in the Bible with this title, the Most High God, is mentioned, is in Daniel chapter 4. In verse 2, the Most High God. In 17, and 24, and 25, and 32, again, spilling over in chapter 5 of Daniel, the verse 18 and the verse 21, but it's Daniel 4, verse 34 and 35 that we are focusing on for a moment or two. These are the words of Nebuchadnezzar. And he teaches us how insignificant man is. He didn't always believe that. He believed the very opposite to begin with. But now his thinking has turned all around and he understands how insignificant man is. And so he says in 35 of Daniel 4, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? That's an echo of what Eliphaz is recorded as saying in Job 4, 17 to 19, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? Behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth. An echo of what Isaiah said in Isaiah 40, verse 15 and 17. Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. That unnoticed drop, clinging to the bottom of the bucket as it is being carried to some other location away from the trough. That dust that drops onto the scales but is of no significance, it doesn't carry any weight. Whole archipelagos, all those clusters of islands out there, all of them God picks up like a child picks up his toys out of the cupboard. The nations are nothing in comparison with God. And when we get a true sight of him, and that's what's lacking in our land today and in our own lives, when we get a true sight of God, we see how small we are. We sink in our own estimate and we cry out, great God, how infinite thou art. What worthless worms are we, how insignificant man is. We were nothing. In our election, Jesus said, ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. John 15, 16, we were nothing in our redemption, for we didn't contribute a single ounce to the work of atonement that Jesus fully made for our sins. I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. Isaiah 63 and 3, we were nothing in our regeneration, because we were dead in trespasses and in sins, and men in that estate of deadness do not raise a hand to reach hold to God and say, Lord, here I am. It is the Spirit that quickeneth. He's the one that gives us life. The flesh profiteth nothing. John 6:63. Good is that reminder coming from William Jenkin, Puritan preacher. Our father was Adam, our grandfather dust, our great-grandfather nothing. How insignificant man is. But how infinite, immutable, and invincible is our God. And that's why in Daniel 4:34, Nebuchadnezzar said, breaking into the verse 34, I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? Nebuchadnezzar spoke of God as him that liveth forever. The infinity of God. There was a time we well recognize it when we didn't exist. There was a time when no creature existed. But in time, beginning with Adam, they came from the hand of God as vessels from a potter's wheel. But God, he's so different, he liveth forever. He is eternal, infinite, without beginning, without ending, as Melchizedek. The infinity of God, the immutability of God, his unchangeableness. God liveth forever. In this respect, he does not change. We must change, whether we like it or not. Most times we don't like it. Time is traveling so quickly. I mean, I'm a grander now. I can't say I don't feel it some days as well. From childhood, sprout into youth. Youth speed on to, suppose, maturity. And, well, I don't think all of us are at the stage where we're frantically checking in the mirror any longer for wrinkles, because we know they're there. It's not just one has appeared. Our grey hairs. I mean, if there's hair there, whatever colour, we're in bonus land. Talking about the men, of course. I've got way past that stage. I'm just now counting the teeth I have left and wondering what I'll be able to eat with what I have. And then from maturity, we rocket into old age. We the creature, the Bible tells us, Romans 8:20, are made subject to vanity. We're on a downward spiral that we cannot change. Lighter than a feather, more frail than the flower of the field, brittle as a grass, fleeting as a meteor, kicked backwards and forwards like a ball across the pitch, quenched as a spark in a pool of water. Lord, what is man? But with God, there are no changes. Has he not said, Malachi 3:6, I am the Lord, I change not. Do we not sing, change and decay, and all around I seem, O thou who changest not, abide with me. And some people today, as in former generations, as from the beginning, think that they can retire God right out of their lives, even destroy him out of this world that he has made. Voltaire had the vileness to claim God was dead. John Lennon claimed, we the Beatles are more popular than Jesus. Voltaire is dead. And he died in such a hideous way that he struck fear into the supposedly stout hearts of his blaspheming friends, as on his deathbed he fought and he struggled and screamed in horror as he descended down into hell, and he knew it, A young Christian nurse who attended Voltaire before he died said she hoped she would never in her lifetime have to be present at another scene like that. Lenin too has gone. So much for all the fools who have cried out, there is no God, or God is dead. You know, there's not an arrow, not a javelin, not a bullet, not a shell, not anything that can reach the throne of God. And yet man thinks he's vulnerable and can be killed and done away with his weaponry. I like the way Spurgeon put it. Let all the nations of the earth rise and rage against God. How shall they reach his throne? They cannot even shake his footstool if all the angels of heaven should rebel against the great king and their squadrons should advance in serried ranks to besiege the palace of the Most High. He has but to will it, and they would wither as autumn leaves or consume as the fat upon the altar, reserved in chains of darkness. The opponents of his power would be forever the mementos of his wrath. And yet in our world today, we have all of these people crazily running around, queuing up to get on the audience in television shows, phoning up radio stations, especially where they're really active, in Twitter, sending out all of these tweets against God, against the Bible, against his children, against anything that is even remotely moral today. But it encourages us. Sometimes we think we're fighting for survival in this oppressive world. It encourages us to know nothing and no one can touch the Almighty. He cannot be killed. He is the God who ever liveth. Then Nebuchadnezzar made mention of the everlasting dominion of God, his reign, Daniel 4:34. And at the end of the day, as I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. We're talking there about the invincibility of God. The God whom we serve not merely exists. Does God exist? That's not the question. He not merely exists, he reigns. Psalm 103:19, the Lord hath prepared his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom ruleth over all. David also said in 1 Chronicles 29:11, thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty, for all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all. Or take Psalm 29:10, the Lord sitteth upon the flood, yea, the Lord sitteth king forever. In this universe, God is actually reigning. Never let us picture him as being in himself, just infinitely great, but not exerting that greatness. Or as being infinitely able and entitled to reign, but nothing more than just a mere spectator as to what is going on in the world today. That is not true. The throne of this universe is not vacant. Its power has not evaporated. God doesn't only hold a bare title to kingship. He actually reigns. And so Isaiah says, the government is upon his shoulders. The reins of authority are in his hands, even when we cannot see or understand it. And what a blessed truth that is. The president, former president of the Orange Free State, said, this was his favorite word in every circumstance, all will come right. And that's engraved on his tombstone. Hopkin Rees, the missionary to China, told about one of his converts in that land in China. She became a Christian, and that stirred up her heathen relatives against her. And they beat her, they locked her up in a room, they tried to starve her into submission. But that poor woman sustained herself through all of those beatings and that starvation and all of that abuse. She sustained herself by the thought that my God is in heaven and all will come right in the end. Mr. Rees had translated an old Welsh hymn into Chinese. The last verse, in fact the last line or so in every verse, read like this: my Father's at the helm, and because he is, let not her heart be troubled. Let's do what Luther did in Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Let's sing the 46th Psalm and let the devil do his worst. God is infinite, immutable, invincible. God is irresistible. I like that little phrase used by Nebuchadnezzar: and none can stay his hand. Those who have studied the verse as it sits in the original Hebrew tell us the thought here is that corrective hand that is applied to a child to stop the child, hold them back from doing something wrong. Nebuchadnezzar saying nobody can do that to the Lord. He has the power to do as he pleases. He will not be held back, chastised, corrected by anyone. Isaiah 45 and 9, woe unto him that striveth with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him that fashioneth it, what makest thou, or thy work? He hath no hands. Despite where man thinks he is and what he imagines he can do, he is powerless to resist the workings of God. He's sitting there like the chaff. And if only he realized it, he'd be terrified. There's a gust of wind coming, and that's going to blow me along. And no part of determination in man's behalf will stop he, the chaff, being lifted up and carried away. This great doctrine of the sovereignty of God, the Most High God, should bring submission to our hearts. King of my life, I crown thee now, profound delight. Spurgeon said, I believe that there is no doctrine to the advanced Christian which contains such a deep sea of delight as this. The Lord reigns. The Lord reigns forever and ever. Why then? All is well. And it brings to us sublime confidence as well. Because then, in the words of Paul, Romans 8 and verse 31, we can say, what shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? It is not the finger of Theresa May who will turn this country around. It is not the craft of her backroom staff. It is not the ecclesiastical figurehead, so-called, in our society. They, in fact, are the biggest blight on our landscape. It is the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. He is in control. He is sovereign. He will shape and dictate the future for us. The resort. In this prayer, we have spent too much time there. We will go quickly on 2 and 3. The recognition in this prayer: I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. David is no novice here as he cries this petition. He's recognizing God had been with him in the past. I will cry. That's now and in the future. Unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. He's dealing, this is what he acknowledges here, dealing not with a God who only has potential power, And he might always be talking about the power, but never gets round to putting the power into motion. No, he's not dealing with that kind of a God. But one whose past actions towards him had been to reveal that power and put it into action on his behalf. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. God had been with him in the past. And when God was with him in the past, every time he was there, it was always a work well done. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. The word performeth in Hebrew only occurs 5 times in the Bible, every one of those 5 occasions in the book of Psalms. It's rendered perfect. Bring to an end. Wrap it up. God Most High can certainly perform, perfect every situation, bring to an end, wrap up those circumstances when he deems it appropriate to do so. And anything coming against us, when God intervenes, he can stop it in its tracks. All the way my Savior leads me, we sang tonight. What have I to ask beside? Can I doubt his tender mercy, who through life has been my guide? That's David in the Kiev. Now when I'm here, harassed by Saul, can I doubt his tender mercy, who through life has been my guide? He certainly didn't, because in the psalm he's pleading, O God, be merciful. Merciful unto me. Heavenly peace, divinest comfort, here by faith in him to dwell. For I know, whate'er befall me, Jesus doeth all things well. And again in this cry, there's a very clear recognition of the fact that with God nothing was impossible. Nothing was impossible. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. And a recognition of the fact as well that absolutely everything was under God's control and working out to David's not only short but long-term benefit. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. Real shades of Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28 is the New Testament equivalent, I would put it to you, of what David says here. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. God had answered in the past. He had performed wonders for him then. Could he not do it now? Could he not keep doing it in the future? That's the thought behind David's pleading. Our enemies today may be many, and they may be mighty. They may be extremely malicious. They can surround us and smite us. The church is declining in power at this moment in time, but we have a sovereign God. Can God save the souls of men? Yes, he can. Can God send revival to this nation in all of its darkness and deadness and depravity? Yes, he can. Can he save it out of the fast tightening grip of the enemy, who are now targeting children, right down to the smallest children? In London, they're unrolling a pilot scheme, sending in men dressed as women, with all of the recruitment and makeup and wild hair, gaudy dress, to read to children as young as 2 years of age in nursery schools. They've already started this, and they're checking to see how well it's accepted, and then they'll expand it even further. Can God save us out of the fast tightening grip of the enemy? He can. Can he work wonders in our land? He can. Can God, despite the hostility and the hellishness that is being channeled against his church, can he turn the tide of sin and replace it with a glorious tide of heaven's blessing and power? Praise his name. He can, for he is the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. The resort in this prayer, the recognition in this prayer, thirdly, the resolution in this prayer. What does he say right at the beginning? In 57:2, I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. He is putting down a marker for his own life. This is such a statement of intent. It oozes with determination. It's a promise, a covenant, a vow. David resolved that he would cry unto the Lord, I will cry. And that resolution is needed from us. I will cry. And maybe we say we've been crying unto God for some time now. And I know we have. And crying very regularly and very sincerely and determinedly and persistently and strongly, resolve to cry on. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. Cry, cry, and cry again until, like David in verse 3, you know deliverance. And that deliverance, and added to that deliverance, all the other blessings, forges a song of praise in your heart and mouth, that you will sing as he did. Verse 7, my heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. Awake up, my glory, awake, psaltery and harp. This is going to be quite a praise service. I myself will awake early. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto thee among the nations. For thy mercy is great unto the heavens, and thy truth unto the clouds. In other words, God had stood up, vindicated his honor, and worked in power. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. The resort in this prayer, the recognition in it, the resolution in it. May we take it as our own and plead it before the Lord Most High.